for a lot of people, it's not even a problem about time, right? It's about connections. Sometimes you just don't have the right connection. You don't know the right people, or you can't afford it, or you don't have the time, or your idea just slips away by the time you find one. And they need, you know, right here in your bedroom, a software you can just type in words and the notes and sing whatever for you.
Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Kanru Hua, the founder of the music software company Dreamtonics, creator of the Synthesizer V and Synthesizer V Studio voice synthesis applications. Culmination of years of AI research, signal processing, and musical passion led to Synthesizer V, which faithfully replicates the nuances of the human singing voice. Its voices are available natively in English, Japanese, and Chinese, and even allows any voice to sing in any of those three languages. During our interview, Kanru and I spoke about the many legitimate uses for vocal cloning, using a clone vocal as a guide for a human singer, creating a voice library, how the field of AI is based on assumptions, and much more. I spoke with Kanru via Zoom from his office in Tokyo. Let's start with Synthesizer. Do you pronounce it Synthesizer 5 or Synthesizer V?
I would pronounce it a V, although it actually means 5.
It does?
Their story.
Okay, so what happened to 1, 2, 3, and 4?
Basically, I started doing this as my hobby project many years ago. At first, it didn't win very well, but I tend to, keep the major version number, just keep incrementing it. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4. That's under different names, but they were abandoned in the end. And 5 is like the first one I got eventually work.
Got it. Okay. Well, let's talk about the thing that I think everybody wants to know about first, and that's vocal cloning. And some people are very much against it, but the fact of the matter is there are other uses for it than the illegal ones, right?
They are. And I have known voice conversion. So from the academic, it is called voice conversion. And it's nothing new. I mean, people have been, at least, in the institute, the colleges, they've been trying it from 20 years ago. Of course, it got nowhere as realistic or as close to the target as we're doing, really everything just picked up in the last 5 years. But I have been studying that, together with voice, and it is all related. The thing is, I think, most of the application you see nowadays on the internet, some of them are awesome from a technical perspective, but they're not having a really positive output. And that's what I think the problem is. So people aren't using it for creative matters, but rather just ripping off existing artists.
Well, one of the uses that I know is happening, because there are some professional songwriters that I know that have adopted voice cloning so they could get closer to the sound of the artist that they're going to be pitching. So for instance, if they're pitching a song to Taylor Swift, this comes off the top of my head, they want a vocal clone of that because they feel it'll make it easier for them, to place the song as a result. Have you seen a lot of that?
In fact, that's where, that's like the motivation behind the product. We first released Synthesizer V, and then went on to Vocal Flex. They are related. The reason is 4 years or 5 years ago, we started to, receive requests from many users. What if I can put my voice into it? What if I can get a Synthesizer V voice to sound exactly, at least in the same genre as a certain artist, so I can use it for my demos? So we're looking into voice conversion, but back then nothing was mature. So it was really just resting, we find there's a possibility you can just really drop in a few seconds of the voice and really, shift the voice into that particular genre to fit your demo needs. So that's like the original motivation for us to develop Vocal Flex.
How long does it take to train it? So I know you have to drop some in, but how much do you say?
It finishes instantly, really just like 10 seconds or so.
Someone had sent me a vocal clone of me, and they cloned my podcast. It wasn't nefarious at all. It was, I just wanted to show you what this technology will do. I made him promise for it not to go anywhere. But That said, I went in and I played a little bit with one of them. And what I found is if I gave it 30 seconds, it was okay, but it wouldn't get my inflections so much. And we're just talking about me talking here. And if I gave it an hour's worth, it got a whole lot better. But singing is different. So I that's why I'm curious, how long does it take before the inflections are, you know, can happen?
That's one really common misconception. So what we're trying to do is not to replicate the inception here. We're primarily focusing on the voice timbre.
Okay.
Because again, you know, since V already handles that part, you know, the basis part, your pitch, the timing, pronunciation. But what a lot of users need really are just different voice textures.
One of the things that I saw in some of your demos, I had played with it a little bit, but what I found most impressive was how much you can change the voice texture. So in other words, you can make the voice growl, even though you don't do it in real life, and yet you could put that in. That was amazing.
I think we still could do better, actually, in that aspect.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, it's pretty cool. You've been working on this for a while, right? I think I read somewhere 2015 is where this started for you.
Actually, before that. You know Vocaloid?
Yeah.
The software from Yamaha, from Japan. It got really huge back in 2011. That's, you know, when 2008, that's when Hatsune Miku came out.
Mm.
So they pair those, back then it's called like a voice libraries with animation characters. And that tends to have a huge cult following, you know, first in Japan, then spread out to the rest of the world. Back then I was still, you know, 2008, I was in grade school. I got really intrigued by that, thinking if I can make my own version of it, you know.
Well, that explains why some of the voices that you have on the side are there. They seem to be very anime oriented, but you just explained why.
That's where it started, because if you time sleep 10 years ago, the voice generation technology was nowhere close to the realism we get today. If you want to push a product back then, it's really hard to appeal to mainstream usage, to producers who want to do serious work with it, because the quality just wasn't there. I think Yamaha probably had the same trouble. So they also did a lot of, and believe me, quite a few years, at least maybe a decade work into finding the perfect audience for their software. And then, you know, the animation market embraced it.
Well, who do you think is the main audience for Synthesizer V?
Well, I would thought, you know, one day technology will be mature enough and it's going to change the way everyone make music. As long as they have vocals.
So it's everybody with vocals.
You know, nowadays, at least until now, when you want to make some vocals, you have to schedule a session with a vocalist. And for a lot of people, it's not even a problem about time, right? It's about connections. You sometimes just don't have the right connection. You don't know the right people, or you can't afford it, or you don't have the time, or your idea just slips away by the time you find one. And they need, you know, right here in your bedroom, a software you can just type in words and the notes and just sing whatever for you.
Well, of course, it's easier to hire somebody online than it's ever been before. But that being said, it doesn't mean you're going to get what you want. And I think that's the problem, because with this, at least you're going right towards something the sound that you want. Like I say, the inflections, everything that you have in mind, where if you hire somebody then and you're not there to guide them, then you don't really know what you're getting.
Speaking of that, people actually also use it to guide real, actual human singers.
Really?
So they will produce a demo track in Synthesizer V and present it, take it to the booth, just play it to the singer. Hey, I want this part to sound like this. Can you add a little bit of my vibrato at the end of the note?
Cool. One of the things that I really liked was the fact that you could stack harmonies. You can dial in the harmonies and stack them, which you can't with other competitors, shall I say. And one of the things I noticed is with competitors, they're really good at doing octaves, but they're not good at doing the harmonies. And that's what everybody wants. But it's easy to dial that in with you, with what you have.
I think, like harmonies are just, doubling. It's kind of getting standard these days. But, really, a part that I think synthesis readers better, in my opinion, is the ability to generate diverse, so different kind of singing styles. If you're just repeating the same, singing style, the same, you know, macro intonations across different tracks and just shape it up and down, they still sound like the same person. It just, you know, it's going to get into beating. If you know, like, you know, two singers play together, it's a little bit of phasing.
Yeah.
So you need to sound different, but different in a natural way.
Yeah. Well, we even have that with, in software, with virtual consoles, for instance, where now what they're trying to do is make every channel different. If you're going to use 10 versions of it, then each one is going to be a little different because that's the way it is in the analog world. So to make it sound more realistic, then that's being dialed in, so to speak. So you're doing the same thing.
Well, I've always been trying to replicate. I mean, the holy grail in this field is to make something that's just completely indistinguishable from a human singing. And one of the challenges, you know, humans are random. You ask the same singer to sing the same phrase three times, and each time it's kind of different.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the beauty of it. I saw that you have support for Pro Tools now as a plugin, which is very cool.
If I will say anything, I think all like the major plugin standards were designed, you know, for more or less the real time use cases. So at one end, you have audio or MIDI coming in, the other end with, you know, not so much latency. You got the audio really hot, fresh out of the oven coming out. But for vocal synthesizers, it really doesn't work this way because even for humans, you know, you have to read the score. You need to know what comes next. The next, you know, a few bars of notes. What are the contents? How do you prepare your muscles for that incoming note? You know, it's predictive, and that latency isn't constant.
You know, interestingly enough, I was just on with a vocal coach, and she was telling me that a big part of what she teaches is the mental aspects, because how you're thinking and how you're feeling influences your voice so much that she had to include that because you have to think a certain way in order to perform at your best and not have your body get in the way. If you
don't. Yeah. Humans are complicated.
Yeah, that's for sure. I saw that you have the synthesizer V engine. So I take it that's you're white labeling the software, right?
We're offering SDKs to fellow business and plugin developers or, you know, web services doubling that are synthesis engine, so without the user interface, as part of their product to enable their product to sing.
Hmm. Okay. That's pretty cool. The other thing is that there's a lot of voices that one could use that you offer on your site. I notice most of them are, they seem like they're Japanese and anime oriented, but it seemed to me like you were also doing licensing deals with other voices as well. Is that the case or did I misread that?
So if you mean for Dreamtonics as a business, we do create our own voices, directly sells to the customers and users. But we'll also provide customizing voice database as a service to businesses. So they're like, you can think of it as like sampler companies that come to us and order custom order of voice to be made. They have their own vocalist and coming to our booth or they send us the files and we process them, train them and send them back a voice database installer that can be redistributed and resold.
Hi, I'm Bobby Osinski, and I'm a best-selling author of several books on recording, mixing, and mastering that are considered the gold standard by many. I recently created a new resource for songwriters, artists, bands, and producers, and anyone looking to fix common mixing problems so they can get a better result, stop wasting time experimenting, and not get buried in information overload. I'm calling it the Mix Fix Playbook, 15 quick solutions to common mix problems. These fixes are well known among top mixing pros, but you probably never knew they existed. If you're looking to create mixes that stand up to what you hear on the radio, Spotify, or TV, go to go.bobbyosinski.com/mixfix to check it out now. So big picture, where do you see this going? Like, what is, you just mentioned that the ultimate was adding some randomness in that, that mimics a unit, a human. Is that where you see this going?
If you mean technically, then, I think definitely get as close to human as possible, but realize that that definition is vague.
Yeah.
You know, when we work on this kind of, even if you're just developing like a vector plugin, right, you have to know whether you're going the positive direction or is the sound quality degrading as you upgrade version by version. And if you're really a scientific believer, you would run listening tests. So hire a bunch of people, ask them to randomly present a bunch of audio file to them, ask them, is it getting better? Is it getting worse? And the average result and do a statistical analysis. We also do that. We do that a lot, in fact. And we ask them whether a new version, we don't tell them which, of course, whether a new version of our synthesizer is more natural than before. And then one day, we found that we just directly compared the synthetic voice to real voice. And we found that people are giving synthetic voice a higher rating than natural voice. What does that mean?
I'm not surprised. I'll tell you why. I was on one of the listening teams for the Line 6 Matrix. And what they were asking for is, okay, here's some samples. This one was done using a real amplifier that's mic'd, you know, with the great microphone and the real signal path. And this one was created artificially with Matrix. After a while, I could pick out which one was which, but I always liked the synthetic one better. So, yeah, I'm there as well.
So the interesting part is, you know, a synthesizer is something outside of the body. It's nothing. It has, you know, artificial beginnings. It's something being designed by humans, but your voice, you're born with it, and yet you think the synthetic voice is more natural.
Yeah, yeah, right. And also, there was a study recently done in the UK, and they found that 46% of music consumers could not tell the difference between something that was AI-generated and something that was real, something that was natural. Now, it could be because they weren't listening closely enough, and it was more like background music to them, but nonetheless.
We made sure that the test participants are actually, you know, people at least having knowledge of at least one music instrument and has several years of education related to music, maybe not, you know, really going to into conservatory or anything, but we also had some trick questions. So there is always like a clearly quality degraded, like low-pass filtered version of the voice presented to them and see if any of the participants cannot filter out that one, then we just get rid of his result. But even doing so, we still find, you know, the same result. And then we design a second run experiment to ask them why. Why do you think one is better than the other?
What are the answers that you get?
We found people really have different tastes. Some of them, actually most of them, are clearly able to distinguish the two systems. I mean, one is natural, one synthetic. But they all have their own preference. Like some would treat, and, you know, humans do a lot of random things like inserting a vocal fry at the beginning of a phrase, like, that kind of thing. And a lot of people hate it. A lot of people like it. The synthetic system doesn't, you know, quite do the same. So it always produces a slightly more smooth, slightly smoother texture or intonations than the real one. And some people define that as natural because it's smoother.
Well, I think we're finding that in modern music production, where everything is time aligned on the grid and auto-tuned, or at least tuned. And you find that I think a lot of people think that's the norm because it sort of is in production, but it's not the way humans really make music. You know, I'm from the old school, you know, we didn't do that. Everybody played together and you got what you got. You tried to get it as close as you could to perfect, but it, you know, you never got there. And now we can make everything pretty perfect if we want. Guess that's what people want.
I think probably a lot of people nowadays have not even seen, you know, really unprocessed vocals.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. You went to school in the United States, didn't you?
I grew up in Shanghai and went to University of Illinois, but I never graduated.
Interesting. Well, okay. Why did you choose University of Illinois?
That wasn't actually my first choice. I was trying to get into Carnegie Mellon, but before, well, that's a little bit of ironic way of saying it, but before the AI boom came in, they had the best, I think, state of art research in speech synthesis. So back then, people all doing concatenative speech synthesis, basically just a huge sample library, but being joined together in smarter ways using algorithms. That was, the best choice back then. So I was trying to get into that place, but got declined, unfortunately.
Huh. And you didn't stay. You say you didn't graduate. What was the reason for that? Did you get a job?
No. So the whole reason I went to the college was because I wanted to make a better synthesizer. I wanted to learn how to make a better synthesizer, a vocal synthesizer, I more or less designed my own curriculum. And I took all the graduate courses in the first 2 years. And at 30, I realized, oh, there's no way I can graduate.
Yeah.
But joke aside, I have my own, synthesis project going on. And it just started as a hobby project, but gradually just eating away more and more time. And until a point, I have to make a choice.
I went to Berklee College of Music, and then I taught there. And I didn't graduate either. But one of the interesting things was the fact that so many of the well-known people that went to Berklee never graduated. And it's mostly because they were so good, they got gigs right away. So after, even a semester or two, they were out on the road. And it's like, well, I don't need school anymore. I'm doing it. And it was encouraged that you do that. And it wasn't good for their business, but nonetheless, it was encouraged. So yeah, same thing.
In the long run, there will still be, reputational benefits to the college, but long run.
Yeah, right. Well, it's a different story now. All right, last question. Since you've been doing this, and really you're in business for yourself, and you're putting all this together, I'm sure you've gotten some really good advice. So what was the best piece of advice that maybe somebody imparted to you, or maybe you learned along the way?
I learned it from my professor. John Allen. I never actually, seriously attended or published a paper in the name of the research team I was in, but they kindly invited me to join their weekly meetings. If I'm allowed to introduce a bit of background,
yeah,
Professor John Allen's group was doing human speech recognition. So it's now like speech recognition you see in the voice assistants nowadays, but rather they're trying to analyze why the human ear hears a pa, and your brain thinks it's a pa, not a ka.
Mm.
Their group was like the closest to our field in, unfortunately, in that university. But still, I was quite interested. I tried to attend their groups and see they actually do a lot of listening tests and a lot of really, really serious and carefully designed experiments. Because you're unpacking such a complicated topic. You're really just breaking down the hearing component. You're going to the middle ear, and all the neural spikes and all the things going on inside your brain. So they have to design a really careful test to see under what conditions people find a constant. One of my favorite words from my professor, he said something like, you have to be really careful of making assumptions. So if I may add to his quote, I will say that you are making most of assumptions when you're not really realizing you're making assumptions. I'm saying that for not just scientific research, but also when doing businesses. You make a decision at some point, you think, hey, it's gotta be it. But always be aware how much, how much certainty you have there. How much a chance maybe your assumption isn't true, and after all the years of hard work, and, oh, made a wrong assumption, doesn't work this way.
Yeah, I have a little story about that as well. At a certain point in my life, I created a startup as well. quite a while ago, and we were searching for money. We're going to VCs. And I remember going to one, and we laid out our pitch and made some assumptions. And he said, well, how do you know? How do you know about this? And that kept on coming up. Well, you say that, but how do you know? And a lot of it is, well, we assumed it. We didn't know for sure. And that really guided me later on when I was put into a similar position of analyzing people's ideas and pitches. A lot of it was, well, how do you know? And the number of times that I just get a blank stare back was amazing because, as you say, we operate on assumptions way more than we probably should.
And I think it's quite unfortunate that the whole, you know, field of AI is based on assumptions, and many of them unprovable assumptions.
Yeah. Yeah. What is one, out of curiosity?
Why does deep neural net work after all? Because the theory only says, you know, there's a chance it'll, you know, accurately predict what you want to predict, but it doesn't say it must. Yeah. We don't see the boundary, you know.
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? And I think we're all learning that there are certain limitations, and maybe we shouldn't assume what it's going to give us is going to be correct. What I found AI best for, to be honest with you, is not looking for facts, but looking for ideas. And just say, give me an idea give me three ideas on this. And it would be really good at that. But if I asked it for certain facts, as a matter of fact, I had a friend who, again, he was advising somebody that was going for money, looking for money. And he went to ChatGPT and asked for the number of subscribers on something or another. ChatGPT gave it a fictitious number and he just put it in. And my friend went to pitch it and the VC looked at it and said, this number is impossible. Where did you get this? So, you know, it just goes to show you that there are certain things that you can rely on and certain other things that you can't.
And that goes back to my point. You know, humans really like randomness. We like entropy, you know.
Yeah, right. Very cool. Well, Conru, thank you so much. I'm so glad we got a chance to talk. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news, and find out about openings for my latest online classes at bobbyosinski.com. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.